Well, I have to tell you that I'm glad that so many of you fulfilled another one of your Lenten disciplines. I'm making it to church on this day, like Saving Beginning Day. And I want to tell you, this is the last sermon in the Making Sense of the Bible series. I'm thankful for all of you who have made a commitment to engage in deepening your understanding of the Bible. I mean, this series is only beginning, though. I mean, there are so many things that we need to wrestle with in the Bible, because it is a book that challenges us to reflect on big questions of our life. This last topic is sexuality and relationships. The Bible is filled with relationships. And we have been discerning it and trying to figure out how our relationships with the people in our lives have changed in our beings as humans and in our understanding of God. The Bible tells a story of God that begins 4,000 years ago and continues through the initial response to Jesus, the Son of God, who overcame death and promised all of us eternal life. But it is still a book about relationships. And relationships are always in flux, and our goal is to deepen them over time. In our book, Adam Hamilton writes about the culture's relationship with or the people's view of the role of women at the time the Bible was written. I mean, there are certain passages of the Bible that are not affirming of women. We all know this. I mean, Hamilton recalls a story of when his third grade daughter began reading the Bible and asked him about the lack of women as heroes. Just a few weeks ago, we heard in our lectionary readings the story of Noah and the flood. For years, as I had the pleasure of telling this story to children when I was the chaplain of a school, and in some ways, it is an easy story to retell. It's about animals and rainbows and you know, figuring out how to fit them all onto a boat, and that's kind of interesting, and it grabs your imagination. But it's also difficult, because all the women in the story are unnamed. There is Noah's wife. There's Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth's wives. But none of them have a name. How do you tell a story when you can't name some of the people who are in it? Later in Genesis, we hear about the patriarch Jacob. He is tricked into marrying Leah, Laban's eldest daughter. He was tricked into marrying Leah instead of Laban's more beautiful daughter, Rachel. But the conflict of the story is not between Jacob and Leah and Jacob and Rachel. The conflict is between Jacob and Laban. Later, Jacob's 12 sons are named, but only one of his daughters, and she doesn't have any role in the subsequent story of Jacob's favorite child, Joseph. For women, the Bible is challenging. It requires a nuanced understanding and an ability to interpret meaning from a position of subjugation. I mean, if we relied on the role of women in the Bible to define how we live our lives, it would be understandable for women to play a behind-the-scenes role in leadership, and in particularly in religious leadership. The Episcopal Church, following the tradition of most mainline Protestant churches and the Mother Church, the Roman Catholics, excluded women from ordained leadership until the 1970s, within most of our lifetimes. There are still churches that continue to subjugate women in church leadership. Those who do use often quoted verses that support that position. One is Paul's directive that women should be silent in churches. And the other one that is often used is that Jesus chose 12 men to be his disciples. But I find these arguments to be problematic. I mean, Paul doesn't follow his directive in practice. I mean, he appointed several women to be leaders of his church plants that he had made all around the Mediterranean area. We have Thecla, who was in Lent Madness, if you had been following along with that. She won her first round in Lent Madness. She was a follower of Paul, who who did a lot of amazing things. There's Prisca and Julia and Priscilla and Phoebe and Junia. Junia is referred to by Paul as an apostle. There's Chloe, who wrote to Paul about what was happening in Corinth. I know Annalise is taking a course right now on women in the early church. She was telling me about it a couple of weeks ago. There is quite a bit of evidence that describes the prominent role that women played in the Bible and in the early church. And it wasn't always behind the scenes. So Paul's verse is either out of context or he failed to follow it in practice. Second part is Jesus did call 12 male disciples that are described in the Gospels. But we don't know much about any of them. We know a little bit about Peter and know something about James and John and something about Thomas. But some of them, we don't even know anything more than they were named as disciples. But there are plenty of others who followed Jesus from site to site and were considered disciples. We know this from the first chapter of the Acts of the Apostles when the disciples, along with certain women, it says, gathered for regular prayer. We know that several women were often part of Jesus' ministry and may have been gathered there with the other disciples. Mary and Martha come to mind, but there is Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. There's a lot of people named Mary back then. And Jesus' mother, Mary. There's also Joanna and Susanna, who supported Jesus' ministry financially. Find that in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus lived in a patriarchal time. Yet women played pivotal roles, and Jesus actively included them. The Bible is about this evolving relationship that we have with each other. We have continued to evolve into what God envisioned for God's kingdom, a mutual respect and power in relationships. Now, this leads to a discussion of sexuality. And over the past 10 to 15 years, homosexuality in the Bible have been hot button issues. I mean, laws have been passed to forbid people of the same gender to marry each other. And the reason often given is the biblical view of marriage and sexuality, the sanctity of marriage, they say. This is certainly not the first time that our Puritan roots have been challenged. 60s come to mind. Adam Hamilton described his evolution on issues of sexuality and making sense of the Bible. He came to Christianity in a church that read the Bible literally. What they called literally, that is. He attended Oral Roberts University, so it was reinforced in his education. But as he continued to read the Bible, he began to ask questions about literal interpretation. And he began to evolve on issues of sexuality. Our president, President Obama, evolved on this issue during his time in office. But in a recent interview, one of his former chief advisors led us to believe that the president's view really hadn't evolved. It just wasn't politically feasible for him to be for it in 2008. I always find it amusing that we ask our politicians to lead us on questions of morality. Maybe I have watched too much House of Cards. The evolution of the frontline politicians shifts with the opinions of people. I taught a 12th grade ethics class before I came here to St. Patrick's, and as I was teaching, we would spend some time exploring the views of well-spoken advocates on the issue of same-sex marriage. And as we got to the end of that unit, I would take a secret ballot vote of the students that were gathered in that class, and usually 12 to 15 students. Every single time. 17, 18-year-olds unanimously said that same-sex marriage was morally right. This would not be necessarily what their parents would have said, but it's what they felt and knew was right. The Episcopal Church experienced some some fracturing when the first openly gay bishop was ordained in 2003. David knows something about that. In some cases, these parishes abdicated from the church over this issue. They said, we can't possibly be associated with the Episcopal Church any longer. When I began serving here in 2010, same-sex marriage had just become legal in the District of Columbia. We had parishioners interested in getting married. It was one of the first things I brought to the vestry and then to the parish for consideration. The two most often quoted verses of those who believe homosexuality is not biblical are these two. One is from Leviticus. If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them. And the other is from Paul's letter to the Romans. It says this: their women exchange natural intercourse for unnatural. And in the same way also the men, giving up natural intercourse with women, were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men and received in their own persons the due penalty for their error. But these scriptures are about power. They're not about mutual relationship. I mean, if you read just those scriptures, it seems pretty clear what the Bible's view is. But we have learned during this series that the Bible is a complex book that requires careful and deliberate reading. I mean, most views can be supported if only a few verses are studied. Those against gay marriage and those who feel that being gay is a choice use the Bible as the basis of their view and proclaim that this country's Christian values are being challenged. The Old Testament heroes had a checkered relationship with marriage, and Jesus had very little to say about marriage and made no condemnations of same-sex marriage. It just wasn't even in a question of that time. The only comments Jesus makes about marriage are his teachings about divorce. And those are challenging. Those make us think and reflect. Jesus condemns divorce and calls people to take seriously the promises they made in marriage as a lifelong covenant. But nearly half of all of the marriages in this country, half of them end in divorce. And divorce is deeply traumatic to those involved and for all the other people that are tangentially involved. But we also know that sometimes it's the only choice. It's the right choice. My feeling is that we need to do careful work in all of our relationships, whether it's marriage or whether it's our relationship with our neighbors, whether it's the relationship with our families, whether it's the relationship with the people in this church. We all have to do hard work to be in relationship. It's about being equal. It is about communicating honestly. Doing that kind of work will be better for marriage than banning people of the same sex from making the covenantal promise in the first place. If you remember, after debating issues here at St. Patrick's, the vestry approved unanimously to allow the clergy here to preside over same-sex marriages. That was 5 years ago. Thankfully, more and more states are legalizing gay marriage. But that doesn't mean that we won't hear more about this issue and its relationship with the Bible. It's still alive in the public forum, and for some serves as a litmus test of true Christian faith. But educate yourself. The Bible is about relationships. And relationships are the most challenging endeavors that we will engage in our lives. I mean, it's a lot easier to just hang out in our own space by ourselves But relationship requires us to go out into the world and communicate and have conversations that are challenging everything that we have. Relationships are about balancing what we need, our desires, and what's good for the whole. It's about realizing that the other person is not perfect, just as we aren't perfect. The covenant of committed relationship, in my mind, is about mutual support and love, and in marriage, intimacy. And I think Jesus would advise us that it is about giving up power and influence and selfishness. And that is the most challenging of spiritual disciplines. So as we have concluded this series, Making Sense of the Bible, I want you to know that we are not done with the Bible. Next month we will begin a new series about our role in racism. We will learn from each other by communicating with each other about how to be culturally effective ambassadors and how that fits into our spiritual discipline of loving our neighbor and letting go of power for the good of the community. This is work that we need to all do, and we need to all do it together.